This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Pelvic floor disorders are brought on when the muscles or tissues of the pelvic area become weak. It's an issue that affects women and men and causes lots of problems like incontinence and pain. Coming up, a pelvic health therapist will join us. It's understandable that people experiencing pelvic floor disorders may be uncomfortable talking about it. Does this cause some to delay getting help? We'll find out later in the show. But first, we're focusing in on maternal health. How well do you think expectant and new mothers are doing in the U.S.? According to a joint investigation from NPR and ProPublica, not well at all. In fact, they found the U.S. has the highest rate of women dying from pregnancy-related complications in the developed world. Did you have complications before or after the birth of your child? Did your spouse, your sister? We want to hear from you. 860-275-7266. Now, joining us now is a reporter for the joint NPR ProPublica investigation. Nina Martin covers gender and sexuality for ProPublica. Her latest collaboration with NPR, Lost Mothers, investigates why the U.S. has the worst rate of maternal deaths in the developed world. Nina, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
How did your project start?
Our project started actually a couple of years ago with a couple of different things that happened more or less simultaneously. One is that editors at ProPublica were noticing that there was a report that actually came out a few years ago from Amnesty International talking about the high rate of maternal deaths in the U.S. and it was sort of really singled out the U.S. as being an international embarrassment. And there had been a lot of, you know, stories about the report itself, but not a lot of deep dive reporting into what was going on exactly. And so that was always a challenge for us, an interesting challenge for us. And as we were doing the reporting, we were came across a really interesting and important statistic that really doesn't get enough attention, which is that for every woman in the U.S. who dies, a multiple of 50 to up to 100 nearly die. And so the rate of women, or the number of women who nearly die from pregnancy complications every year in the U.S. is estimated to be about 65,000 by the CDC. And so that really resonated with me because about 17 years ago, almost exactly, I had a sister who gave birth and who nearly died in the postpartum period. And I remember the trauma of that. I remember how painful that was for everybody. She luckily did survive. She's fine. But I was, you know, but at the time, it was one of the things that made it so hard, especially for her, was the sense that nobody at the hospital and, you know, anybody really seemed to know what was happening. And B, when it was over, it was kind of treated as if it was an incredibly rare thing. She was a unicorn. And in fact, you know, it's not nearly as rare as people think. And so that's kind of was the genesis of the big project. And then we started looking at maternal deaths and trying to find out, you know, who was dying in the U.S. and telling their stories.
Now, Nina, how difficult was this to get a deep dive in this information? I understand reading through your reports how states and the government track maternal deaths is in question as well.
Right. So the U.S. has really bad tracking of maternal deaths and near deaths, for that matter. The big problem is with the states. It's really up to the states to collect this data and to analyze it, to try to understand why maternal deaths happen, and then what can be done about them. And the CDC basically we sort of relies on, there's like the statistical modeling, and then but for the real information about what's happening and why, you know, it's they rely on the states, and many states don't have a process at all. I think it's about, the last time I looked, I think it was at least 15 states don't have a process at all, or the process is so new that it barely counts to analyze maternal deaths. And then after that, it's, you know, and then a lot of states that do have a process in place don't do a very good job of it. The data that they collect is really inconsistent, and then it's made more complicated. And because of the there's a something called a pregnancy checkbox on birth certificates that's supposed to help the CDC keep track, but it's been that has proven to be highly problematic and confusing, and there's a lot of both undercounting and overcounting. So there was that. And then the other thing is, of course, that even for researchers, they don't actually know who died. They don't know much about the people themselves who die unless they happen to come across them in their own lives or their own practices. When they do these analyses, the information is pretty much stripped out. So they don't know a woman's name. They don't know where she went to the hospital. They don't know her family. They know a lot of things from her medical records. And so we felt that it was really important to try to find women who actually had died and to really try to understand their stories. And that has taken up, been an enormously difficult process, as we've discovered, because, again, because this data is not collected, because it's shrouded by hospitals and regulators, and because even families themselves have sort of been conditioned to sort of think about maternal deaths and near deaths as being private tragedies and catastrophes. And, you know, they don't mention them. They haven't, until very recently, until our reporting, in fact, they haven't really, very rare to find even the mention of a death in an obituary.
Now, Nina, so, an estimated 700 to 900 women in the U.S. died from pregnancy-related causes in 2016. Through your series, Lost Mothers, you identified over 100 of them. What complications did these women have?
Well, the women that we found had all the complications. I would say that we actually found closer to 150. We identified about 120 in the story that you're referring to, and we've since gotten more names. They die from all the well-known complications, so hemorrhage and preeclampsia, which is pregnancy-induced hypertension, infection. They die from things that would surprise a lot of people. In fact, at the moment, most of the deaths, the majority of deaths, maternal deaths in the U.S., researchers have found, are actually heart-related. So cardiac diseases of various kinds and pregnancy-induced heart failure. Those deaths account for like 25% of the deaths right now, according to researchers in the CDC. And then we found that people die of things that are, even more surprising. So, for example, there's been a big increase in opioid-related deaths, obviously, during pregnancy. And researchers are realizing that some of those deaths, not all of them, but some of those deaths might be directly linked to pregnancy because they are pregnancy or childbirth. They're women who who may have pre-existing mental health issues or substance abuse issues that are not addressed adequately during pregnancy, and especially in the postpartum period when they often lose medical coverage and they don't have access to antidepressants and anxiety medications and other things. And so that it could cause, so pregnancy and childbirth, it's really hard for any woman, no matter how healthy she is. And it's really, it can cause a real spiral for women who have mental health issues and substance abuse issues.
This is Where We Live. Today, we're looking in on why the U.S. has the highest rate of maternal deaths in the developed world. These are women who die due to pregnancy-related complications. On the phone with us, Nina Martin. She covers gender and sexuality for ProPublica, her latest collaboration with NPR, Lost Mothers. And I wanted to bring into the conversation now Dr. Catherine Campbell, assistant professor of maternal fetal medicine at the Yale School of Medicine, joining us today from the studios of Yale University in New Haven. Dr. Campbell, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you so much for having me.
This might be surprising to some of our listeners that the maternal deaths are so high in this country. Why is that the case?
So first of all, I'd really like to thank Nina Martin for bringing this to light in the public realm, because this has been something that we have been talking about in my line of work for quite some time. And we are very concerned about the rise and lack of decline in maternal mortality in the United States. So I think there are, as Nina really outlined, lots of reasons why this is happening. But the ones that are the most concerning to me have to do with the lack of access to reliable and effective care, reproductive health care, lack of universal health care to women across the United States. And those are two main issues that I think are really important and need to be addressed to start to help decrease maternal mortality across the U.S.
Now, I mentioned that you're an assistant professor of maternal fetal medicine at Yale School of Medicine. How much of this is also an emphasis on when we're pregnant, families, the focus is always on having a healthy pregnancy because you want your child to be delivered and be healthy and that baby thrive. But how often are doctors looking at the welfare of the mother after that baby is born?
Yeah, so I think that's a great point. You know, as a maternal fetal medicine doctor, I do spend a lot of time talking to moms about being healthy throughout the pregnancy, throughout the delivery, and in the postpartum period. But I do think that physicians and hospital systems and medical organizations are partly at fault for spending a lot of time talking about fetal health and the health and well-being of the baby after delivery. And a tremendous amount of research dollars has been placed in the area of fetal and neonatal well-being. And we've seen dramatic improvements in decreasing the perinatal mortality rates, decreasing infant mortality rates, while maternal mortality did decrease significantly over the turn of the century and through the middle of the 1900s. And for the last 25 years has been stagnant and is probably even increasing. And so I think that this has been a call to action, that we are failing, and we're failing moms, and we're failing families, and we really need to put attention into this area.
I want to go back to reporter Nina Martin again for ProPublica. Your story, you did research on how other countries are handling maternal deaths. And when you look at Great Britain, I mean, their rates are very low. What have they done that the U.S. should look into?
Well, as Dr. Campbell says, the UK, as she points out, access to healthcare is really important in this conversation. And the UK, of course, has a national health system. So there really, you really don't see the kinds of systemic sort of issues that in the UK, I'm sure there are plenty of problems in their medical system, but lack of access isn't one of them. And so what that means is that women have preventive care, they have good reproductive care, they have contraception, they have access to the right kind of clinician during pregnancy. For some women, it's who have very relatively simple and normal pregnancies, uncomplicated pregnancies. It might be a midwife for women who have high-risk pregnancies. It's an OBGYN. Or higher risk, I should say. And then once they give birth, there's a system in place to take care of that mom and baby. And, you know, postpartum care is not a problem in the UK the way that it is in much of the US, access to care. So that's where it begins. Another place that's really different, and we have a story coming up. I'm not writing it. It's being written by a journalist who is working with ProPublica, and she's also a medical student in the UK. And so she's writing about what it's like to practice there, and you know, when a woman has a complication, and the difference, the differences of care and so forth are quite typical. But one of the big differences is that women, is that doctors are sort of, and clinicians are told from the very beginning that their first priority is the health of the mother. And I think that I want to say that I have never come across a doctor or a nurse or any kind of medical person or hospital, you know, that says, well, we don't care about mothers, because of course everybody does. But it's one thing to sort of care about mothers, and it's another thing to kind of put it at the beginning, at the forefront of the way that you care. And then when for them during pregnancy in this period. And then of course, and in the UK, when something goes wrong, specifically a maternal death, then there's a whole very elaborate, very centralized, very thorough process in place to understand what went wrong for in each of those cases. In the UK, maternal deaths are really seen as system failures, very much akin to an airplane crash, because they understand that a death is not, the death of a mother, a new mother is not, or a mother-to-be is not just about her. It's about, like, ripples throughout a community for, a very long time. And so, and then when they do this really thorough analysis, then they publish the results, not with identifying the woman, but the findings in a report that now comes out every year that contains really very important ideas about how to improve the system of healthcare for all women. And so it's just a very different process. And that's how the UK has managed to bring down its maternal mortality rate over in recent years.
We're going to take some listener calls in just a moment, Nina. But I wanted to just ask you, we were talking about the UK. I wanted to come back home. And when we look at the discussion and the debate over reproductive rights in this country, whether or not to repeal and replace Obamacare, no other state has the kind of attention on it than Texas, when you see some of the laws that that state has tried to have on its books and the courts have ruled on some of them. But when we look at access to care and contraception in Texas, what does it look like for women there in terms of maternal deaths?
Well, you know, Texas had a spike in deaths, a really big spike in deaths, I think in about 2011, 2012, 2013. That is was just documented by researchers last year, almost exactly a year ago. And there's a lot of questions about what is going on, why it's going on. I think there was an immediate sort of, you know, Texas is well known and in some places they would say notorious for the cuts to reproductive care that it's made consistently over the last few years. Every year you think, okay, they can't get any worse, and yet somehow it, you know, there's new ways to cut back on care to women. And so the initial, and including abortion, obviously, access to abortion, and but also family planning money, family planning clinics, defunding Planned Parenthood, et cetera. And so the immediate assumption was when this big spike happened that people looked and said, oh, that's exactly when Texas was starting to, you know, really cut back on the clinics and everything. But the deaths in Texas, the spike seems to have happened actually before. A lot of the worst of the cutbacks, the most infamous of these cutbacks in abortion access and family planning access were made. And so I think what's going on in Texas, and we are looking at this, is something that has been going on for a really long time. Texas is a state with the highest uninsurance rate. It is a state that did not take the Medicaid expansion. It is a state that has many rural hospitals, and there's been a lot of really good recent reporting, you know, underscoring the fact that that the maternal deaths are significantly more likely to happen in rural areas. It's a state with, you know, in Texas, the big disparity, as it is in most of the rest of the pretty much all of the rest of the country, is in deaths involving the black-white disparity. So black women are 3 to 4 times more likely in Texas and in most parts of the country to die than white women. In some parts of the country, it's actually worse. So something bad was already happening in Texas, I think, and then the reproductive cuts came on top of it, and we can assume that they have not made things better. But I don't know. I think in Texas it was already kind of bad. That's what my conclusion is.
I wanted to take a call now. Again, we're talking about maternal deaths in the U.S., the highest in the developed world. On the phone with us, Nina Martin, a reporter for ProPublica, worked on an investigative series with NPR looking at maternal deaths. And from the studios of Yale University in New Haven, Dr. Catherine Campbell, assistant professor of maternal fetal medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. Just want to take a quick call. Kristen from Windsor is on the line. Kristen, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. Hello, everybody. I'm calling mostly based on my own experience, but I'm calling to ask if there are any tracking mechanisms for what happens when mothers with undiagnosed, preeclampsia go into full eclampsia after birth and then die. Because I had a high-risk pregnancy 8 years ago. I delivered twins. I developed all the symptoms of, many of the symptoms of preeclampsia, and my OBGYN, who, by the way, is connected with Yale, where I delivered my twins, told me, oh, I don't have it because I wasn't having headaches. I had a massive, massive seizure a few days after my twins were born and almost died, and the neurologist that sort of put me back together said, excuse me, said this should have been caught. And when I went back to my OBGYN, she was completely dismissive and said, well, it's hard to it's hard to catch these things. You didn't have the headaches. You know, I had extreme swelling. I had visual field effects. I was 45 years old at the time. So I was told that, well, you know, it's a hard thing to diagnose. So my question is there a way or a mechanism or an institution of some sort that's keeping track of misdiagnoses earlier in pregnancies for women who are at risk or also feel that they have developed what they believe to be life-threatening complications?
I'll let Dr. Campbell take your question, Kristen. Thank you. Dr.
Sure,
Campbell?
Sure. Kristen, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. And I think you bring up a really important point in that, you know, we talked about access to healthcare and disparities in that access, but also I think that education of both patients and providers regarding these common causes of pregnancy complications so that we can better recognize them in a timely fashion and really minimize the significant morbidity that preeclampsia, for example, can have. And I think earlier today this was highlighted in terms of education by nurses at the time of discharge. And I think that we need to strengthen and our education system that happens for patients before they come into the hospital, for providers and for nurses when they are educating patients at the time of discharge, and also coming up with the best practices. How can we give the information that we know, how can we give that to patients so when they go home, overwhelmed by a new baby, recovering from a delivery, but then also wanting to be aware of important things that might come up so that they can be an advocate for their own health care and when warning signs and symptoms come up. And I think that physicians, midwives, other providers also need to be aware and recognize that these things happen. They happen probably more commonly than we realize, and we want to be able to catch things before they happen to turn into something like eclampsia and a seizure.
Nina Martin, again, a ProPublica reporter on the line with us. Dr. Campbell just referenced your latest story with NPR. Tell us about what you found when postpartum nurses were surveyed.
Well, what we found is something that is, I think, well, didn't necessarily surprise us. It confirmed basically what we've been hearing from many, many women who have similar stories, unfortunately, to your caller just now, this is specifically about nurses. We've heard about doctors and other clinicians as well, that they're really particularly unaware about complications that arise in the postpartum period. This was a small survey of nurses who belong to the leading professional organization. A third of them actually had graduate degrees. So although it's a small study, it was quite interesting. And a survey, and only 12% of them knew that that maternal mortality is most deaths occur in the postpartum period. That's pretty surprising for a postpartum nurse. Most of them almost a half of them didn't know that maternal deaths have been rising 20%, almost, I think it was 19% thought that maternal deaths, have actually fallen in recent years. Only 25%, about a quarter of them, could realize that heart-related complications are the leading cause of death in the U.S. And a lot of them said things like they didn't feel that it was necessary to tell healthy women that they thought were healthy about scary complications like the kinds of things that your caller experienced in her after she gave birth, unless there was, you know, reason to do it, unless they thought there was a need to do it because maybe somebody had pre-existing conditions, and it certainly sounds like she did. So I think that the study really underscores a problem. It also shows, though, that, you know, education is really possible. A lot of it is educating nurses and empowering nurses and women, you know, sometimes to deal with doctors and so forth. And, you know, it's one big problem in this country isn't just access to care. It's that when you have care, whatever it is that you very often can slip into the cracks because there's no continuum of care. You're not seeing the same people typically when you go back to the hospital, you start to have complications. You're not seeing your postpartum caregivers. You're not seeing people who delivered your baby, and they may not have your records or whatever. So there's a lot of continuum of care issues as well as complication or as well access issues.
Nina Martin covers gender and sexuality for ProPublica. Her latest collaboration with NPR, Lost Mothers, investigating why the U.S. has the worst rate of maternal deaths in the developed world. Nina, before we head to break, if our listeners want to get more information to you for this project, where do they go?
They go to ProPublica.org. That's ProPublica.org. And you'll just come to our project page, which is called Lost Mothers, and there's a lot of materials there and also a form that you can fill out to tell us your story, which we really want to hear. Thank you.
I want to thank you, Nina, and we'll also tweet out links on Twitter at Where We Live. Thanks, Nina, for your time.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Coming up, Dr. Catherine Campbell, who specializes in maternal-fetal medicine at Yale School of Medicine. She's going to stay with us. We're going to hear from a former Connecticut resident about her experience after having a baby. And we want to hear from you, too. Have you had pregnancy-related complications or someone in your family? Did you feel your OBGYN or hospital staff gave you the right information when you were discharged? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. When you're pregnant, it's only natural you want to do everything right to have a healthy pregnancy and child. And when you go home, the focus is on doing everything right to help your new baby thrive. But does that lead mothers to avoid signs when they aren't feeling quite right? How do OBGYNs and hospitals counsel new mothers in those critical days and weeks after having a baby? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Email wherewelive at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Now, we're considering these questions after a startling investigation by NPR and ProPublica, which found the U.S. has the worst rate of maternal deaths in the developed world due to pregnancy-related complications. We're going to learn more about these complications. Again, Dr. Catherine Campbell is with us. She's assistant professor of maternal-fetal medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. She joins us today from the studios of Yale University in New Haven. We wanted to hear another personal story, and on the phone with us is a Connecticut native, Emily McLaughlin, who is now a creative writing professor out of state. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I understand that you had a baby at Greenwich Hospital in 2015. Tell us about how your pregnancy went, and was it a normal birth?
Yes, it was normal in the conventional, the pregnancy was normal in the conventional sense of the word, and that my routine checkups, everything was normal, blood pressure was low, ultrasounds normal. My blood pressure was a little bit high during my labor. In retrospect, I did have some, I guess, during the pregnancy, I did have some smaller symptoms that may have been a little bit abnormal, such as nosebleeds, a lot of breathlessness. I was induced labor, long labor, a lot of headaches during my pregnancy, and then postpartum, a lot of swelling in the couple days postpartum.
Now, when you were having these symptoms, I imagine you were telling your OBGYN that you were having them. And what were you being told during your pregnancy?
Again, they all fall under the category of kind of that they're not that. They can all fall under this kind of term of, I think, normal. And because the routine lab work and everything else and blood pressure are kind of the more major tests, that was all, I guess, normal or in range. So I wasn't technically high risk. I was also 31, 32 at the time. I don't fall into any high risk categories as well. So there was no other kind of, I think, warning signs that also kind of served as red flags when combined with other smaller symptoms.
So you had your baby, everything went well. What happened the few days after you were discharged?
So I had a regular vaginal delivery and was discharged from the hospital 2 days later. And then so it was on the fifth day post-delivery, so 5 days postpartum. That was actually the first day that I officially began breastfeeding. I came down with about a 5 o'clock that day. I came down with a very severe headache, which they refer to, I guess, with the brain hemorrhage, they refer to that as a kind of thunderclap or a sledgehammer headache, which is actually how I would describe it. At the time, and with nausea, the headache with nausea was my major symptom. I would, at the time, my husband and I believed that it was probably from dehydration. It was a hot day, and I had breastfed that entire day, hadn't eaten much. And so I think we waited a couple hours. I tried to eat, took a shower, tried to get some fresh air, called my OB. His partner was on call for him. And she, I think, not intentionally didn't also. I had, again, had kind of nothing really major, no blood pressure problems during my pregnancy or during my labor. So she had told me to just try to get some sleep, to kind of supplement my Motrin with some Tylenol. And she, I think, was trying to not inconvenience me by having me take the baby and rush to the ER, because I had asked if I should go to the ER. And so we waited a little bit longer, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, I realized I was seeing spots, and the headache was just becoming more severe. And I knew that at that point that I had never been, I assumed that it was a migraine. And I thought, I was Googling also during this time, I thought that I had assumed that it was, I didn't know anything that it could be, that anything that could happen postpartum. So I thought that maybe this has to do with dehydration and breastfeeding. So I was Googling for hormonal changes. And so that's what I thought it was from. But on the way to the ER, I had a stroke in the car on the way to the emergency room. And when I arrived at the emergency room, I had lost my speech and was having a brain hemorrhage.
So the ER staff, when you arrived, they knew that you were having a postpartum stroke?
Yes, they knew immediately, and they got me care immediately.
Mm. When you're going through your story, Emily, I'm just curious, when you were discharged, was any of this, did you get any information about things that you should be watching out for in those days after?
No, unfortunately, no. Some information, I think, about how to monitor blood for hemorrhaging, I think, which was probably, I don't think was given to me written, but I think was the OB nurses were, I think, trying to instruct me on that, how to care for kind of my body. But nothing about blood pressure, nothing about headaches, nothing about swelling, nothing about symptoms of heart failure, nothing. I didn't know anything about any of this, that anything at all could go wrong at the time. Otherwise, we would have gone to the emergency room immediately. Mm-hmm.
I should mention, because we knew a little bit about your story through ProPublica, we did reach out to Greenwich Hospital, and they decided to not provide a statement. But I wanted to bring in Dr. Catherine Campbell again from Yale School of Medicine into this conversation. Dr. Campbell, as you listen to Emily's story, I mean, what is your reaction to, I guess, how it transpired?
So, Emily, thank you for sharing your story. I mean, I find the story very powerful, and these are the things that keep me up at night as an obstetrician. And I think it again highlights the need for research and funding at the federal and state level for how to best deliver the information to patients when they have gone through lots of times a long hospital stay for their delivery hospitalization, so they can go home and they can have some real critical and key information available to them at their fingertips for what is normal and what really warrants, you know, finding a caregiver for the baby and heading into the emergency room. And, you know, a lot of symptoms that are normal with pregnancy, there's a lot of overlap with abnormal, and OBs spend a lot of time trying to parse out the normal from the abnormal and just a routine headache from one that's related to hypertension and is putting the patient at risk for stroke. So there's always going to be that overlap, and there's always going to be OBs calling a patient in and it ends up being just a routine headache that's controlled with some Tylenol and some rest. But, you know, we don't want this happening. We don't want new moms having a stroke in a car on the way to the emergency room because they didn't get there in time.
I was thinking back to my two pregnancies, Dr. Campbell, and during the pregnancy, you hear a lot about preeclampsia, and I didn't realize that women could suffer from that even after they've had their baby.
Mm-hmm. So preeclampsia affects about 5 to 7% of all women. Hypertension in pregnancy in the postpartum period is extremely common. When I cover our busy labor floor, we send patients home who have had a pregnancy affected by hypertension every day. Mm-hmm. And it's there, and that risk continues even after the baby's born and the placenta is out. And I think we need to do a better job educating patients about this.
So for people that are listening, what should women be looking for, or even people in their family be looking for in terms of warning signs after the delivery of a baby?
Sure. So, you know, obviously you're going to have a lot of information from your prenatal care and from your delivery hospitalization. So you're going to know if you already have some risk factors for preeclampsia, and that should be outlined for you by your care provider. But going home, things like increasing swelling, vision changes, headache, abdominal pain. And lots of times I tell patients, you know, listen to their bodies. Every day after you are, you know, from every day after you've had your baby, you should be feeling a little better. You're going to be tired and you're going to be worn out, but overall you should be feeling better and feel like you're moving forward. Anything that really sets you back and doesn't feel like it's right to you, I encourage my patients to call so we can have a conversation on the phone about what's happening, what they're experiencing. And in general, I have a low threshold to having patients come in for an evaluation because women know their bodies best. And if something feels off, it's probably because something's off. And sometimes it might just end up being, you know, reassurance and recognizing a normal postpartum symptom that maybe the patient wasn't aware of before. But we want to catch these things before they become big problems that have life-impacting consequences for these moms.
This is Where We Live. Today we're talking about pregnancy-related complications and how that's impacting the rate of maternal deaths in the U.S. With us is Dr. Catherine Campbell, Assistant Professor of Maternal Fetal Medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. And also on the phone with us, Emily McLaughlin, a Connecticut native who now lives in Michigan. She survived a postpartum hemorrhagic stroke. Emily, how are you doing now?
I'm doing really well, thanks. It's about 2 years after this has happened, so it's been 2 years recovering. I went back to work teaching at the university, at the University of Michigan, and recovered probably within a couple months, regained all my functioning, and then unfortunately, a year later, did suffer another a grand mal seizure as an aftershock of the brain bleed. So that was kind of another setback. So now I'm maintained on epilepsy medication for that. But otherwise, kind of life is back. We're caring for our toddler, and life is pretty much back to normal. The research that Nina and ProPublica and NPR has done on this, I think, has been pretty healing and for my family, and that's helped us really understand, I think, a lot of what kind of happened to me and hasn't made me feel like this. I'm such an anomaly that this happened. Has brought a lot of closure, I think, on the whole entire experience.
And Emily, we just have a couple of minutes left, but what advice do you have for expectant or new moms?
I guess that it's okay to be terrified, I think, but it's also but not to be uninformed. I think that that they deserve information. So deserving the information that, like, about that these things can happen. They are, what happened to me is very, very rare, and it is very low. So I don't think that it is, you know, it's not very likely that it is going to happen to most expectant mothers. But that doesn't mean that they should have the information of what to do if the signs and symptoms do come on. And also if a tragedy or crisis does strike a family, that, you know, I think to be the woman or be the mom, who kind of does break the silence on some of these maternal morbidity issues, be the compassionate person who kind of speaks up or asks them how they're doing.
Well, we're glad to hear
and
that
kind of destigmatizes the issue.
We're glad to hear that you're doing well, Emily. Thank you so much for sharing a little bit of your story. I want to take a quick call before we head into break. Jason's calling from West Haven. Jason, we just have a minute. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to thank Dr. Campbell and the staff at Yale because our second child was born there, and it was after my wife had already had an ectopic pregnancy, which is why I am on the phone right now. They were great. Anyhow, my wife and I happen to already have a child, and we live right across from the UConn Medical Center in Farmington, and she was having, you know, some regular feelings like any other menstruation. Excuse me, it's tough for guys to say these things, but that being said, things all of a sudden, the uncomfortableness it continued to exist more so than regular. So that being said, brought her to the ER, and they said, well, Maggie, you're pregnant. And that was great news. Okay, we were happy, but still, she's been pregnant once before. They said that every pregnancy is different, blah, 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 blah. And the thing is, I want to make sure that any woman, any young lady that may be able to get pregnant or is thinking about being pregnant, or at least knows what an ectopic pregnancy is or the symptoms, because we had to go back to the hospital when I happened to be home that day, thank God, but I heard a thump in the kitchen. My wife was laying on the floor, eyes wide open, lips blue. Threw her into the car, ran over to back to the UConn Medical Center. And even getting into the emergency room to get anyone's attention in the staff to try to get them to take the situation seriously, because we were there the week prior, was very, very, very difficult. Everyone was basically like, just wait, you know? So I ended up finding an EMT in the hallway to take a look at my wife.
Well, Jason, we're running low on time, but we thank you for letting us know about the complication that your wife had, the ectopic pregnancy, but that she was able to deliver and to survive. We thank you for telling a little bit of your story with us. I just wanted to also thank Dr. Catherine Campbell. She's going to remain with us because we wanted to focus in on something that a lot of people don't know about in terms of postpartum care and even care for men, and that's pelvic physical therapy. A physical therapist from Griffin Hospital in Derby, Connecticut, is going to join us. And we'll continue to take your questions, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We've been focusing on mothers this hour, and we've learned how vitally important postpartum care can be. But how are women counseled when it comes to their pelvic health? And this is not just a women's only issue. Men face pelvic health disorders, too. To tell us more, joining us from Griffin Hospital is Jennifer Passoni, doctor of physical therapy specializing in pelvic floor therapy at Griffin Hospital's Center for Pelvic Health in Derby. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about pelvic floor therapy and how common are these disorders?
Oh, unfortunately, very common. Millions of people suffer from disorders associated with the pelvic floor. And you might be asking, what is the pelvic floor? So I want to start with that. The pelvic floor is the bottom of the pelvis. It's made up of the muscles that help support our organs and help control our bowel and bladder function. And if these muscles become too weak, things can begin to leak or fall out. And if they become too tight, pain and dysfunction can occur. So as physical therapists, these are the types of things that we are helping our patients with. Some common diagnoses that we treat are stress and urge incontinence, both urinary and fecal. prostate surgery complications, pain issues including constipation, post-surgical pain, scar tissue, and pre- and postpartum pain issues.
When you talk about your patients, how often do you see people in terms of after having a baby?
Very often. We actually treat pre- and postpartum. So we see lots of moms coming in. Their bodies are going through some significant changes during pregnancy, making their muscles weak, tight, or painful, leading to any of the things that I've already mentioned, the incontinence pain, painful intercourse, back pain. So we're trying to get the word out and get as many of these women in to see us as possible while they're still pregnant so we can help them manage their symptoms and teach them how to avoid or minimize any dysfunction that may occur after delivery.
Dr. Catherine Campbell, again, with the Yale School of Medicine. Do women and men know enough about pelvic floor health?
So I think it's a common topic of conversation in OBGYN's office. Again, I think like maternal mortality and having certain taboos around conversations in the public arena about this, the same thing happens and has happened with pelvic floor health. But I think with changing demographics, more women are feeling comfortable bringing this up as an issue with their OBGYN. And it's something that we talk about, you know, during prenatal care as well as in the postpartum period.
I wanted to go back to Jennifer Posoni again from Griffin Hospital Center for Pelvic Health in Derby. We just have a couple of minutes left, Jennifer. I understand that your health center also serves men, but that's not always the case. Tell us a little bit more about the male patients that you're seeing.
Well, men have a pelvic floor as well, so they can experience the same types of dysfunction. Many of them don't know where to go, who to talk to. We work very closely with our area urologists, colorectal physicians, and primary care doctors to help educate them about some of the dysfunction that can occur so that they can refer their patients to us as soon as possible so we can help get their life back on track.
And any issues with coverage from insurance? Is this something that people can get care for?
Yes, absolutely. It's physical. You know, it's physical therapy. You know, we're doing things with them like patient education about, you know, lifestyle modifications, exercises to strengthen and retrain the pelvic floor. We're doing bladder retraining, and these are all things that are covered under normal physical therapy services. So, at Griffin Hospital, we accept a wide range of insurances. So, we're able to provide care to a great deal of the population.
Well, I want to thank Jennifer Posoni again, doctor of physical therapy, specializing in pelvic floor therapy at Griffin Hospital Center for Pelvic Health in Derby. Thank you for telling us a little bit about your specialty and the importance of checking out people's pelvic floor health as well.
Yes, absolutely. I hope more people speak up and look to take back control.
Thank you, Jennifer. And Dr. Catherine Campbell, Assistant Professor of Maternal Fetal Medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Campbell, you know, much of this show was focusing in on the fact that, again, in the U.S., we have more maternal deaths than any other country in the developed world. Some parting thoughts on for our listeners, whether they're pregnant now or they hope to be pregnant soon, about some of the things that they should really know about.
Yeah, so I think that as a nation, we need to continue to talk about this important topic. I really think we need to create a centralized national database where we can review maternal deaths like they do in the UK, so we can read through that information and whittle down the important points for providers and for patients to reduce maternal mortality. I don't think we're going to be successful without having that happen.
Dr. Catherine Campbell, again, thank you for joining us from the studios of Yale University in New Haven.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show produced by Lydia Brown. Special thanks to WNPR intern Tim Cohn. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. You can check out WNPR.org/where we live for more about the show. Tomorrow we're going to return to a topic that's pretty important. We've done it before, but we need to do it again, and that is the topic of opioid overdoses in our country and also here in Connecticut. Join us tomorrow. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.